It's 4:06. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up a little later in the show, we'll learn how music therapy is helping people suffering from memory loss.
First, we turn our attention to Congress. Yesterday, the U.S. Senate voted to bypass a filibuster as a two-year federal budget deal inched toward final passage. And, as we just heard, they voted to approve that deal this afternoon.
After years of political gridlock resulting in sequesters and government shutdowns in the past, how'd we get to the deal?
Philip Joyce joins us now. He's a professor of management, finance, and leadership at the Maryland School of Public Policy. Philip, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much. It's good to be with you.
Well, 2 months ago, gridlock and a government shutdown, who would have thought that there'd be a compromise deal passed by the Congress just 2 months later?
Yes, well, there might not have been one if it hadn't been for gridlock and a government shutdown. I think the most significant reason that we have an agreement today is that enough people figured out that it wasn't in their political interest to have yet another last-minute showdown, much less another government shutdown. The other thing I think we have to keep in mind is that while this is significant in the sense that people reached an agreement, it's a pretty small agreement. So a lot of the things that people would have gotten a lot of heartburn about, like tax reform and major entitlement reform, are just not in here. So it doesn't mean that there aren't things that some people don't like. There just aren't enough things that enough people don't like to keep it ultimately from happening.
We've heard the phrase grand bargain brought up on and off over the last couple few years. Really, this is not a grand bargain by any stretch of the imagination, is it?
No, this is a teeny tiny bargain. A grand bargain would be something where we had done something to affect the long-term trajectory of the deficit, and that would invariably mean something that most people in Washington call tax reform, but that really means increasing taxes on people and major entitlement reform. You just can't get enough money out of the appropriated part of the budget to make a significant dent. And the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget, which is kind of a grand bargain advocacy group, estimated that the result of this would mean that by 2030, that is the result of this agreement that we just reached, instead of the debt being 78.9% of GDP, the deficit, or the debt rather, would be 78.7% of GDP. So this is really, it's a step in the right direction, but it's by no means the grand bargain. If there's going to be a grand bargain, it's still somewhere ahead of us.
The last political hurdle was really yesterday on that filibuster vote, and a number of Republicans in the Senate actually joined the procedural vote to pass this through to get that vote today.
Right.
Were you surprised that I think it was a dozen Republicans voted to not have the filibuster?
I was somewhat surprised, although, you know, there are a number of Republicans, especially in the Senate historically, but increasingly maybe even a few in the House, that have grown tired of this and have been looking for bipartisan solutions of some kind. The other thing, I was looking through the list of Republicans who voted for it, and I was trying to line it up with when these people are actually going to be up for re-election. And of the people who voted for the motion to continue debate, there are really only two of them that are running for re-election in 2014. The only two who voted for it who are running for re-election in 2014 are Lamar Alexander from Tennessee and Susan Collins from Maine. And certainly they didn't make their political lives any easier by doing this, but the other people who voted for it are either people who are retiring, who aren't going to run for election again, or they're people who aren't going to run for re-election until at least 2016, and that's a long time from now, and lots of things can happen between now and then. So a little bit surprised, but not really shocked.
And the way this shook out, a couple of Senate Republicans who are facing Tea Party challenges, most notably Mitch McConnell, got to have it both ways a little bit. They got to make their vote, in effect, against passing this thing for a filibuster that didn't happen. So they could say, look, I voted against this budget compromise, but they still got the budget compromise.
Correct. And it's true in a lot of votes in Congress that there are people who might be willing to vote for something that's not in their political interest if their vote is needed. But clearly, the vote was not needed here. I mean, the vote yesterday was 67 to 33. The vote today was 64 to 36. So both of those votes were comfortable votes, meaning it passed by a comfortable margin. And I think you're correct that even the people who might in their heart of hearts not be desiring another government shutdown didn't necessarily have to vote for this.
So we've had so many conversations over the last bunch of years, really, about brinksmanship, about taking it up to this fiscal cliff deadline or that budget deadline where we've got looming disaster in October. We went over the deadline. Do you think that that's going to change? We're not going to be running up to deadlines. Is today's vote a sign of things to come?
Well, look, I would say this is success. I mean, it might only be success relative to the low expectations that we've developed for Washington, but any time that the Congress doesn't do the smallest thing possible at the last possible minute, we should at least pause for a second and recognize that something unusual, if not significant, has happened. And I think it may matter politically because it's a small indication that the parties can work together. I mean, I was one of the people that when they said, you know, Paul Ryan and Patty Murray are going to get together and they're going to try to hammer this out, I wasn't real hopeful. And even though it's a small deal, I think that once people get used to working together, maybe they'll work together on larger things. I didn't realize until a colleague of mine pointed it out that that the last time we had a conference agreement on the budget resolution, and while technically this isn't quite that, that was the framework, that is the reasons Senator Murray and Congressman Ryan were coming together is because they're chairs of the budget committee. The last time that we had an agreement on the budget resolution when the House and Senate were controlled by different parties was 1986.
Wow.
And so that's significant when you think about exactly how partisan things have gotten. And it might be a case where we really had to kind of go past the brink in order for people to realize that they don't really want to go there again, even if the only reason they don't want to go there again is political.
So they don't get the blame for going there again. Well, we've got we can put it to the test, this new bipartisanship. There's a new deadline. Is it next month already on debt ceiling? What are the politics leading up to that?
Well, I don't think the debt ceiling deadline is yet next month. I think the most immediate deadline is going to be that while this established the framework for the appropriation bills, they haven't actually passed the appropriation bills. The continuing resolution expires on January the 15th. So by January the 15th, they have to be able to reach agreement on the actual appropriation bills. I think that's likely given this agreement, because I think the big hang-up was what's the number going to be, not what are the details going to be. The estimate on when we hit the debt ceiling is kind of all over the place, but most people say not before March, and if we get past that, it turns out April 15th is kind of a significant date for the federal fiscal future, because a whole lot of tax revenue comes in on or around that day. So if we don't hit the debt ceiling by March, it might not be until May or June, but it is going to happen, and there's nothing about this deal that they passed today that deals with raising that debt ceiling. So this will be another opportunity if the Republicans want to try to use the debt ceiling as a bargaining chip, as they have tried to do before, where they might try to get some concessions on some larger things. But having said that, I think they sort of showed in the fall that they are not really willing to let us default on our debt, and I think the president now knows that they're not really willing to let us default on our debt, which they shouldn't be. So the question of how much they can use that as a bargaining chip, I think, is sort of up in the air.
We'll keep an eye on that as it develops. Philip, thanks a lot for joining us.
Oh, I appreciate it very much.
That was Philip Joyce. He's a professor of management, finance, and leadership at the University of Maryland School of Public Policy.
Coming up, we'll find out how music therapy is helping individuals who suffer from memory loss.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up later in the program, we'll find out about the illegal ginseng harvesting that's taking place here in Wisconsin and what the DNR is trying to do about it.
First, WPR reporter Terry Bell recently spent some time learning about the relationship between music and memory and how iPod therapy is being used to connect the two.
You may have seen the viral video from a couple of years ago. An elderly man, his name is Henry, sits distant and unresponsive in a wheelchair. He has Alzheimer's disease and can barely answer the simplest questions.
Hi, Papa.
Huh?
How you doing?
I'm all right. I'm fine.
Who am I?
That is until a nurse gives him an iPod and a pair of headphones and turns on his favorite music. He suddenly comes to life. His hands and feet sway, his head bobs, and for a fleeting moment, he's the man he used to be.
Do you like music?
Yeah, I'm crazy about music. And you play beautiful music.
What was your favorite music when you were young?
Cab Calloway was my number one band guy. I liked it. Did the holy, the holy, the holy, the holy, the holy, the holy, the holy.
We were intrigued and wanted to find out more about the link between music and memory. Our search took us to the Oak Ridge Long-Term Care Facility in Osseo. That's where Angela Bulger is the Assistant Administrator of Senior Services. She says the music we love when we're young, music therapists say, from age 16 to 24, strikes a chord deep within us that lasts our entire lives.
Music is one of the last things that goes. They can always relate to that. So even if they can't remember the words to the song, they can still remember the beat and the melody of it. And it really, it brings the individual back out.
There are about 29,000 people living in nursing homes in Wisconsin. The Wisconsin Department of Health Services says a little more than half of them have Alzheimer's, dementia, or some other kind of memory loss. Ramona Krause is one of them. She injured her spinal cord in a car accident decades ago. She admits she has trouble remembering sometimes, but when she puts on her iPod, she seeks out her favorite artists.
Oh, Don Ho, Cooey Lee. Cooey Lee had a good one, I'll Remember You.
Long after this endless summer is gone.
And suddenly she's back in Hawaii, where she worked as an X-ray technician at the American Naval Base at Pearl Harbor and waitress at the Enlisted Men's Club part-time.
And they were just huge clubs, you know, like 2 to 3 football fields. And so, you know, that brought back the pain of working there, but the memory of what was going on at that time.
The National Music and Memory Project is embraced by the Mayo Health System and the Wisconsin Department of Health Services, among others, but it's a fairly new initiative, and while the short-term results are compelling, any long-term benefits for people with memory loss is still a bit of a mystery. Licensed music therapists like Brenna Beecroft of Milwaukee say they want to wait and see, but they already know music has proven powers over our minds.
In commercials, in the store, it affects our behavior and we don't even realize it. We use music to make ourselves feel better. So in that regard, it's absolutely going to be beneficial.
Beneficial in that music and memory may reduce reliance on medications, reduce agitation, and make residents calmer and more social and just plain happy. If you have an old iPod, the Mayo Health System will take it off your hands and give it to someone with memory loss to help make their lives a little more musical and a little bit better.
Thanks, Terry, and thanks to the Music and Memory Project Foundation for some of the audio in that piece.
iPod therapy is just one example of music therapy in action, and here to tell us more about how else music is being used to soothe and heal is Brenna Beecroft. She's a music therapist and the public relations chair for the Wisconsin Chapter for Music Therapy. Brenna, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
Well, Brenna, what do you think it is, having worked closely with this kind of therapy, what do you think it is about music that can have this healing power with us?
Well, music connects us to former memories and specific life events. It also can alter brain chemistry, specifically, you know, the feel-good hormones, endorphins, that you get, you know, like the runner's high, but a music high. It affects the body physically in decreasing tension. So it's a system-wide response. It's not just that music makes us happy, it's that it affects us from our brain all the way throughout the entire body.
I'm hoping you can give us some background on music therapy. When did we start to see this take hold, that music could be so helpful in the healing process?
Therapeutically, music has been used since people began to sing, really. Shamans, bards, there's a whole history of using music to connect people and to heal people. But it really began to be called music therapy around or just after World War II, when some of the veterans that were coming back to the United States were responding really well to music in the hospitals, specifically for post-traumatic stress syndrome, for pain management, to help ease anxiety, to help reintegrate them socially into communities. And so they started developing university programs to train people, to give them the background, to give them the skills necessary to go in and be able to process some of the emotional responses to music and to start and understand the physical and physiological responses that we can use or we can manipulate music to specifically get in a predetermined sort of way, not a coincidence, but going in and making these results happen.
Now, we've heard about how music is being used to help people with memory loss, but it does go beyond that. Can you talk about some of the other ways that music can be used to treat different things?
Absolutely. Music can be used on the whole spectrum of life, from infants in intensive care units to help them regulate their heart rates, their respiration rates, to help them intake more nutrition so that they can be released either to go home or out of the intensive care unit faster. Even children in school settings, music therapy can be used to help them learn and practice academic skills, coping skills, social skills. Moving to adults with disabilities, it can help them to learn leisure activities in an adapted manner. So music therapists can help adults that may have a physical or cognitive limitation be able to play an instrument and do it successfully because we're able to alter either the instrument or the way we teach. And music can go even to the end of the lifespan, at the very last moments of life, and giving people a peaceful and comfortable passing, making sure that they're pain-free, that they are connected with their loved ones in the last moments, and that may be more towards benefiting the loved ones around the person who's passing. But music can absolutely be used at any point in the life. It's really something for all ages and all abilities.
How widespread is this here in Wisconsin and in our healthcare facilities?
The last time I looked, there were approximately 150 music therapists practicing in Wisconsin, which means that they have a board certification. They passed the national exam. They completed the four-year university program. I know a lot of music therapists work in activities or life enrichment departments in skilled care or nursing homes. Some work in hospitals, some work in mental health facilities, some work in school settings, others work in private practice. It's becoming very, very common to see music therapists, although it's more common in some of the bigger urban areas, Milwaukee, Madison, Green Bay, Fond du Lac, a little bit in Eau Claire. But you will find music therapists even in some of the more rural or remote areas as well.
You mentioned that it could actually be used to treat pain. How is that possible? How can music treat pain?
This is one of the most important aspects of my personal work in music therapy. Music therapy can work in a few different ways to help manage pain. One, we understand that at the base of the brain, there is essentially a gate, a door, if you will, that is the point at which the brain recognizes or processes the pain impulses that come from wherever in the body the pain is originating from. Music can actually help to block some of those pain impulses from entering into the brain. So that the result is the decreased sensation of pain. But music can also create distraction. And if you've ever had a headache or a muscle ache, the more focused you are on your pain, the more intense it becomes. So music's ability to distract can really ease pain by refocusing attention. Even if it's briefly, it can help decrease that sensation of pain. And furthermore, pain can actually help improve your coping ability. So it may not actually decrease the pain itself, but it might increase your tolerance for the pain. So even at the same level of pain, you're better able to cope with it or tolerate that level of pain than you would or would have previously.
We're talking with music therapist Brenna Beecroft about the healing power of music, and we want to hear from you. Have you experienced music therapy as a patient or a provider? Maybe you've watched a parent or grandparent come alive when hearing an old song, as Terry Bell told us about a little while ago. What was that like? Are you interested? Do you have questions about music therapy that our guests can answer for you? Here's how to reach us. You can call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can send an email. The address is talk@WPR.org.
We'll pick up that conversation with Brenna and take your calls right after the news. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about music therapy and the healing power of music. And we'd love to hear from you. Have you experienced music therapy? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Our guest is Brenna Beecroft. She is a music therapist, and she is with the Wisconsin Chapter for Music Therapy.
And let's go to the phones right now. We have Pat joining us in Sauk City. Hi, Pat.
Hi.
Hi. What do you think?
Well, I was, I'm actually a nurse practitioner, and I spend most of my time in nursing homes. And so I had a patient once who was had pretty severe dementia and was actually end of life. And the Wisconsin Chamber Orchestra came to play at the nursing home. And she was up in a wheelchair, and she actually managed to propel herself in between two of the players and sat there and tapped her foot. And this woman, it was just so amazing because she was, you know, as I said, pretty much end of life and very demented. So that was just, it was very touching.
Yeah, that's a remarkable story. And there are others like that, people who respond to music when they won't really respond to anything else. Brenna, how do you account for what's going on in stories like Pat's?
Music has the ability to motivate people. It specifically, it makes them move. How often do you hear a catchy song on the radio or a march on the 4th of July, and you don't notice it at first, but you start tapping your feet? Music has that response, a physical response as well. So it was probably able to, the music was able to give her that boost of energy to wheel herself forward in her wheelchair when maybe without the music she wouldn't have been able to. She probably loved the music they were playing, and that was the motivation to get closer to the music, to touch it, so to speak.
Thanks for the call, Pat. We'll go now to David in Wausau. David, hi.
Hey, great program. I've been a believer in this for a while, and I have an anecdotal story about my mother, who passed a couple of years ago from vascular dementia that afflicted her the last 4 to 6 years of her life. I was wheeling her down the aisle at the facility she was at the time, and I had already been plugging her into my iPod for a while, so this was in the summer of 2010. And I had everything on there from Rosemary Clooney to Bob Marley. It was my iPod, and it just seemed to calm her down. And a funny thing happened one day. You know, she generally would tap her feet and her hands to the music. And I'm wheeling her down the aisle, and all of a sudden she blurts out, "Stand up for your rights," which was, you know, a Bob Marley lyric to a popular Bob Marley tune. And so I just want to say, yes, I want to affirm the therapeutic value, and great program, and keep up the good work, everybody who's working on dementia.
Thank you so much for the call, David. Well, we've heard a lot about the use of music. I know that's not the only use of music therapy, but in dementia, I mean, is that kind of a frontier of music therapy, Brenna?
It's a very popular area for music therapists to work in, although they don't necessarily do just music therapy. They may work in an activities department or a life enrichment department, which means that they're highly underutilized because music therapists can be used to help manage difficult dementia behaviors such as agitation that happens in the afternoon, which we refer to as sundowning. It can help with depression. Our elderly in facilities often experience great losses, and with those losses, surely, you know, they experience feelings of depression and sadness over that. Music can help regain some control in their lives by making choices again, by being in control of a piece of music, a song, playing, singing. So music therapists can be very beneficial in the life of our elders by giving them that control, by making them physically comfortable with pain management, by helping with agitation and stress and anxiety. It's a total body health and wellness sort of intervention.
If people don't have the resources to work with an actual music therapist who's been trained to do this, are there simple things that they can do themselves with their loved ones or even working with themselves to make themselves feel better or their loved one feel better?
Absolutely, absolutely. Music can be included in just about every aspect of life, from exercising, getting the motivation to exercise on a regular basis, to just interacting with someone else. I know with individuals who are caring for someone with dementia, sometimes it's hard for them to connect with them outside of this new role as a caregiver. Husbands and wives don't feel like they're husbands and wives anymore. Mothers and daughters, you know, fathers and sons. It's hard to connect when the person with dementia can't tell you what they think, what they feel. They can't make choices. But music can be that one little spark that connects people, that moment where you hold someone's hand and you don't need to say anything because the memory of dancing around the Christmas tree, for example, when you were growing up, or singing a silly song together at bedtime, or any number of memories that can be brought back with music, and you don't have to say a thing, and that can really create a connection between two people.
We have an email from Elizabeth. She writes, I'm a high school junior, and I'm very interested in music therapy. I've shadowed a few music therapists in the area, have started touring colleges that offer music therapy degrees. I can't imagine being anything other than a music therapist. She goes on, I play clarinet and piano, taking advanced placement psychology, trying to learn as much as I can about music therapy, want to make sure I'm prepared. She says, do you have any advice? Sounds like she's got a great start there.
Absolutely. She knows what she wants. Keep with it. It's a passion that is a calling. You know if it's the right field for you, and there are going to be hard days, but the music makes it all worth it. The music is your reward as well, and you get to see immediate feedback from the work that you do as a music therapist, and that's one of the reasons why music therapists are often in the field so long. They retire in the field because there is a whole system of rewards that goes with it, beyond the enjoyment of being a musician.
All right. Well, good luck to Elizabeth. And let's go next to Katie in Ashland. Hi, Katie.
Hi. I was just calling to kind of reiterate that conversation about, like, connections. My older sister has Down syndrome, and a lot of the social-emotional things that she really wants to express and maybe can't or has a hard time expressing, she firstly will use music, and then she turns to it, too, and she's feeling really, when she's having a really hard time, she'll turn to it firstly to help her kind of get through what she needs to get through. She'll send me text messages, music messages, where she's recorded whatever little blurb of some Dolly Parton song or Britney Spears song or whatever she's listening to that says the words that she can't quite say to me at that moment. And it's very meaningful, and it's a wonderful connection for her and I to say, hey, you know, remember that song and how it makes us feel. And it's a real special bond.
Oh, that's a cool story. Thank you, Katie. And that's another aspect of this, music expressing things. You know, like you said, we can't always express ourselves. Music can do it for us.
And there's a song for everything.
Definitely. So looking ahead, what does the future hold for music therapy? Anything interesting or exciting that you see in research or on the horizon or how people are applying this?
On the research front, it is growing by leaps and bounds, and music therapists aren't the only ones doing the research now. So you have people like music psychologists, you have neurologists doing research, and working together, we have different technologies that we can utilize to show the effects of music, but still use the skills and the background of a music therapist to make sure that the music is the most effective music for whatever response that they're looking for. Hopefully in the future, we're getting close, we're not quite there, but hopefully in the future, music will be a reimbursable item. Your insurance company will reimburse for music therapy. Medicare, Medicaid will reimburse for music therapy. It is happening, but it's a little bit inconsistent now, so I'm really looking forward to the day when you go into the doctor and he writes a referral for music therapy.
Interesting. Well, we'll be watching for those changes. Brenna, thank you so much for being here today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
We've been talking to Brenna Beecroft. She's a music therapist and the public relations chair for the Wisconsin chapter of music therapy.
Coming up after the break, we'll find out about an investigation into illegal ginseng harvesting here in Wisconsin and what the DNR is doing about it. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. For many of us, the holidays aren't complete without a favorite food or drink. In today's Wisconsin Life, writer Julie Buckle's grandfather was famous for the holiday cocktails he served, not necessarily because they were good, but because of the memories that drinking them stirred.
In the 1980s, my grandpa retired from farming, as much as a farmer can ever really retire. He and grandma sold the farm to their son Willard and moved into a ranch house in Viroqua. At Christmas, Grandpa would set up shop in the basement and lure the men of the family down to his small TV with a football game on. He served two mixed drinks down there. One was a brandy slush made with snow from the yard. My brother, who was 12 or so at the time, remembers picking leaves and twigs out of his drink. Grandpa's second holiday cocktail was a Tom and Jerry, an old-school hot toddy made with different combinations of eggs, powdered sugar, brandy rum, bourbon, mixed with milk or hot water, and a dash of nutmeg. The key to the drink, which Grandpa perfected, really is not in the quality of the mix, but the quantity of the booze. Stores sell the egg mixture in the refrigerator section during the holidays. I don't know where he got his original supply, but no one remembers ever having fresh Tom and Jerry mix. What they remember is freezer-burned Tom and Jerry mix pulled out from the deep freeze year after year, mixed with hot water and lots of cheap liquor. Grandpa lived a long and ripe old life. Despite rolling his own cigarettes for 45 years and eating eggs and bacon for breakfast even longer, he died in 2001 at 92. And so ever since, I've taken to making Tom and Jerry drinks Christmas Day just for the chance to say his name and hear the stories about him one more time. Grandpa was a large man who wore pinstriped overalls during the week and a suit and hat on Sundays. He was the undisputed patriarch of the Buckles clan. He knew all, saw all, and micromanaged as much as he could. In his retirement years, he patrolled a circular route to check in on the families of his three kids that lived within driving distance, checking on the crops and cattle of Vernon County, and devising work plans and recruiting work crews to carry out these plans. As teenagers, my siblings and I would hit the floor when we saw his car drive in. He was looking for blackberry and plum pickers or walnut gatherers. The slowest to the ground lost, usually my younger, kinder sister, Stephanie. But then, at weddings, graduations, and anniversaries, Grandpa would be the first with his glass raised for more champagne and the first to pass the bottle on. I'll be thinking of Grandpa on Christmas as I whip egg whites into a froth, making Tom and Jerry's drinks from scratch. I use better liquor and gourmet ingredients, but I doubt my brother, dad, or uncles notice. They're too busy telling stories and remembering those long-ago freezer-burned days when Grandpa served Tom and Jerry's every Christmas Day.
Julie Buckles is the author of Paddling to Winter. She lives near Lake Superior.
Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. This episode is produced in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. You can find more info at wisconsinlife.org.
The Wisconsin DNR just wrapped up a year-long probe that resulted in over 100 citations. The target of the probe, illegal ginseng harvesting in the state.
To avoid over-harvesting, picking ginseng in the wild requires a special license and other rules and regulations must be followed. But with buyers looking to pay top dollar, harvesters are increasingly skirting the law to get their hands on the plant.
Joining us now is Courtney Ripp. She's the ginseng program manager at the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. Courtney, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
So tell us about this illegal ginseng harvesting. How widespread is it?
Well, it's pretty spread equally throughout the entire state. It definitely follows along where ginseng is found more often. So along the west central region in the driftless part of the state, there's a lot more ginseng. So there's a lot more violations in that part of the state than in others, as in northern Wisconsin, southeastern areas where ginseng isn't as prevalent.
Why is there such demand for it?
Well, it's very sought after from Asian cultures. It's used for all sorts of medicinal things. They prescribe it just like our doctors prescribe us medicines for all sorts of ailments. Chinatown and things like that, they have Wisconsin ginseng kind of pulled out. It has a very great reputation, and that's mostly due to the cultivated industry in Wisconsin. But it's highly sought after, which drives the price for it, and the price in turn drives the how much it's harvested.
Do you have a sense whether this ginseng that's picked illegally is being sold in Wisconsin, or is it being shipped over state lines? Where's it going?
Well, that's hard to determine. Most of the ginseng, it will stay in Wisconsin for a while. They'll sell it to some of our licensed dealers. And then those dealers, in turn, sell it all over the country. They sell it to other dealers in other states. But I would say most of it ends up in other countries. So mostly Asian cultures like China, Japan, Korea, Taiwan, those are generally the hot spots for it. But to try to follow a single route is pretty impossible to do when there's so much volume going throughout the state.
Is there something about Wisconsin's climate that lends itself to growing ginseng, or is this something that other states are grappling with?
It's definitely something that other states are dealing with as well. There are currently 19 states and one tribe that are authorized by the Fish and Wildlife Service to export wild ginseng. And so it's something that's pretty much found just, with the Minnesota line and then the east. It's pretty much the only place that it's found in the United States. And so other states are definitely dealing with issues as well. I do believe Maine this year just recently cut off harvest on state properties, which left their residents very upset because there's so much building and there's so much development going on that there's not a whole lot of private land available anymore. And so state land was pretty much the only place they had to harvest. So it's definitely something that goes on in other states as well.
How is the ginseng harvest managed here in Wisconsin?
Basically, we have the rules that are in place through administrative code and statute, and then we have licenses. We normally thought before this project that people knew the rules and that they were generally following them. And we realized after this project that while that's very true, there's a great number of harvesters that are out there that are good stewards of the plant. There are some that just don't know what the regulations are. You know, they heard about it in a story, they saw the dollar amount, and so they just went and bought their license, and that was it. So we just have a lot of education to do. But as for managing the plant, you can't harvest it on state land, so that leaves private lands, and we can't tell people how to manage a product on their own land. So it gets a little bit more difficult in that aspect. What we can do is encourage sustainable harvest, only harvesting a few of the older plants and not all of them, to encourage reproduction of ginseng. And then also just ensuring that our own state properties are knowledgeable of what they have on their lands, and encouraging management of the plants on those properties as well is something that we're looking towards.
No, I know you don't want to encourage people to harvest ginseng without the proper license and whatnot, but it must be quite an incentive for people. How much is it selling for?
It's very, very high this year, and I kind of dread telling people how much it's worth because that just kind of entices people more. But as far as I've heard so far this season, it was kind of record-breaking where it was up to $900 a pound for dry ginseng.
Oh, boy.
Which is substantial, no matter what the economic situation is. But given the current and recent economic situation, it's very enticing for people to go out and get their hands on this plant.
Is this something that's easily cultivated? You know, could Wisconsin just turn this around and turn it into an economy?
Well, we do have a very well-established cultivated program in Wisconsin. And in fact, Wisconsin is kind of the birthplace of the cultivated industry. Whenever you go through Marathon County, I'm sure you've seen the fields where they've set up shade cloth about 3 feet high off the ground, and that's ginseng underneath there. And they've created an amazing market for it. There's the Ginseng Board of Wisconsin, and there's a co-op, and it's a great, great program that they've had set up. And there was recently an agreement set up with Governor Walker in China where they agreed to, I don't even remember the amount, but it was quite substantial. and it's the cultivated ginseng is going over towards China for medicine. So it's a very substantial program at this point, and we already have that. But the wild ginseng is different because it's able to stay in the ground longer, and therefore the portions of it that are most effective in treating different ailments are more concentrated in the older wild ginseng plants than they are in the cultivated ginseng plants, because there's generally a fungus that can attack the plants in a cultivated setting, and it can wipe out an entire crop. And that's a risk that most people are not willing to take, understandably. And that's why there is such a big difference in the value of the plant.
What happens if somebody gets caught? And, you know, you issued a lot of citations last year. What are the penalties if you're caught harvesting some ginseng illegally?
It is similar to a large speeding ticket. Generally around a couple $100 is what the fine is for it. And then if you are a repeat offender or you've done something, you know, more seriously wrong with the violations, then you may be revoked. We can revoke a license for a year, and then for repeats within a 3-year period, we can revoke a digger's license for 3 years.
So you had this investigation last year, Project Red Berry. How did you go about catching these people?
So it actually took place in September of this year. So it was it's something that we worked on for the past year developing this. But it basically just came from using the tools that we had, you know, looking through records. And it was a very systematic approach where nobody was singled out. We looked at all the records, and we were able to pull out things that just looked a little weird, where we weren't sure exactly what was going on. And we assembled a team of wardens, and they went out and just talked with people. And that was pretty much the entire project. It was very successful. I've had a lot of great feedback from people who were even interviewed as part of this, who were glad that we were finally doing something to help protect this plant.
Well, Courtney, thank you so much for being on today and telling us about this.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
We've been talking to Courtney Ripp. She's the Ginseng Program Manager at the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources.
Coming up next, we'll talk about the impact that party culture has on colleges and universities and the people who live near party schools. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.